It's good news, bad news, George. The good news is the Pfizer tests look good and we'll have a vaccine shortly. The bad news is that it's about 2 months before Joe Biden takes over. And that means this administration is going to be implementing a vaccine plan. The vaccine plan is very important. And it's probably the most ambitious undertaking since COVID began. And the Trump administration is rolling out the vaccination plan. And I believe it's flawed. I believe it learns nothing from the past. They're basically going to have the private providers do it, and that's going to leave out all sorts of communities that were left out the first time when COVID ravaged them.
That was the serially overpraised governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, reacting this morning to the fantastic news, not the good news, bad news, but fantastic news that Pfizer has developed a vaccine to COVID-19 that's 90% effective and on the verge of being rolled out perhaps as soon as this very month. Hello, everyone. Welcome to what might be called VC Day or Victory Over Coronavirus Day, hopefully, maybe, an occasion which, if true, is really worth having all-night dance parties in the street. I am Matt Welch, joined by my trusty colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mengyu Ward. Hi, pals.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday, everybody.
Peter, this news just broke. I am not a doctor, but you play one on television. Can you walk us through what happened and what is this tangibly going to mean for the future of Western civilization?
So the short version is that this is preliminarily very good news. Pfizer, working with a German company that specializes in messenger RNA technology, is currently showing better than 90% effectiveness for its vaccine. Depending on how the trial proceeds, they could have approval and tens of millions of doses available by the end of the year. If this holds true, it's great news, but we're not out of the woods yet. For one thing, these results aren't final. They don't have approval yet, although they may well have it before the end of the year. They still have to proceed with the test, which basically means waiting for their population to get another, I think it's about 75 more people have to catch COVID out of their group. And what they do for these tests is they have, of course, people who get the vaccine and then people who get a control, and they wait for a certain number of people to get COVID. And if virtually all of those people are in the, not the control, but the placebo group, then that tells you that the placebo group is getting it and the other group isn't, right? And so what they want to do is wait till they get even more people, hopefully in the placebo group, who have COVID and that they can look at that. And so in this one way, the giant surge in cases is actually going to work in our favor because it means that that is probably going to proceed faster. So a couple of other things to consider here. The 90% figure is for people who have never had the virus, not for people who were previously infected. As with people who get infected, we don't know how long immunity lasts. This could last 6 months. It could last a year. It could last much longer, but we do not know and will not know for a while. Another thing, distribution is going to be logistically complex. Messenger RNA tech has to be heavily chilled during transportation and storage. Also, it's a two-part shot, 3 weeks apart, which means double the work, which is just more of a kind of bureaucratic administrative headache for rolling this out. It's going to be months and months before many Americans get this. Just another thing we should probably be aware of here on the Libertarian podcast is that Pfizer paid for the R&D on this on its own and began working in conjunction with its German partner all the way back early in the year. I think the German company started in January, and they had already been working together on a flu shot for the last couple of years. But if I understand correctly, Operation Warp Speed, which is the vaccine acceleration program set up by the Trump administration, is going to end up paying for a lot of the doses. Back over the summer, Pfizer signed a $2 billion contract with the Trump administration, basically saying that if and when they get a vaccine that works and that is approved, the Trump administration guarantees that it will buy about 100 million doses of that and then distribute that to the country for free. So it's a bunch of government money. I mean, a relatively small amount in the context of the federal budget, but $2 billion that is contingent on successful development. And then that is how the distribution is going to end up being free for at least most people, if not everyone in the United States.
That's the bad news. Peter, what's the good news?
I mean, you know, the best part of this is the 90% figure. a lot of folks who were watching these trials who had insider information. I was sort of talking to people behind the scenes, and they were thinking that 70% effectiveness would be a stretch, would be a very good number, and they were bracing themselves for something more like 50 or 60%. And if you have a vaccine that is more than 90% effective, then that means that fewer people are going to have to take it in order to create real herd immunity. And it also means you can be much more confident on your own that once you've taken it, you are going to be safe from COVID. So again, we are not out of the woods. This isn't over. It's going to be months and months before most Americans have access to this. But a drug that is 90% effective, relatively inexpensive to make, that is very, very good news.
Catherine, before Nick flings poo in the general direction of Andrew Cuomo, please clap.
I will clap. This is good news. It's good news.
Just put those hands
down. Nope. Look at them. Look at my long, creepy fingers. So I have two thoughts about it besides Peter's excellent rundown there. One is I do think there's a scenario where if this vaccine process is indeed as far along as it looks like it is and will be by the time that Biden takes office, we may avoid the fighting over a national mask mandate or a quasi-national mask mandate pushed through the states via the threat of reduction in federal funding. I would love to avoid that. I would love that. You know, obviously there will still be a need for many individuals to make choices about mask wearing. There may be a need for broad social norms about mask wearing. But if the vaccine is far enough along and effective enough, maybe we could just not have that stupid fight. And I would love that. The other problem slash solution facing us here is the conspiracy theories. My God, you guys, the timing on this is really good stuff for the internet crazies. Like, they're ready to do it. And as I've said, perhaps more than any other repeated phrase on this podcast, always assume incompetence over conspiracy. Always assume coincidence over conspiracy. That is such a good rule for life. Like, the fact that this was announced today is, it's not because Bill Gates is going to microchip us all in the Biden administration or whatever. It's not.
Are you sure?
It's because Bill Gates has already done that.
Yes, thank you. Nick, in the full clip of the Cuomo thing, he says later that the important thing is that we depoliticize this and we just follow the science. Do you think that he's fulfilling that prime directive?
Yeah, obviously and completely. And I just want to point out before I talk about that Peter had earlier mentioned that in that full clip, which is absolutely worth watching, Andrew Cuomo sounds incredibly like Christopher Walken. And it really, you know, what's good about that, if you focus on that, you'll pay less attention to the actual content of his speech and the content of his character, which is a problem. You know, this is, it's a little too much to take getting lectured on coronavirus protection plans from, you know, a governor who had the most spectacular fail in terms of policy. And to his credit, or, you know, and I realize Cuomo is Italian, not Jewish, but the chutzpah, or maybe the sprezzatura of, you know, writing a book about how goddamn great he was and how New York strong and, you know, New York bold and blah, 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 all of this is. It's awful. I mean, it's good news that a vaccine is in the pipeline. I tend to be a little bit cautious about early optimistic projections, but hopefully it comes out and it comes, you know, comes online sooner.
So, I mean, we should just talk about that Cuomo thing a little bit more, because his main objection is that the distribution plan he is expecting is going to be mostly run through the private sector. And the private sector is where the vaccine was developed. The private sector is where the vaccine, where multiple vaccines are being developed. The private sector is what is working the best here. And when, and I don't think we got to it in the part of the clip we played, but if you listen to the interview a little bit longer, you know, Stephanopoulos asks, well, what would you do differently? What should Joe Biden do differently? What's the actual alternative plan here? And Cuomo doesn't actually respond with a plan. He just reiterates his complaint that it is privatized. It's a complete knee-jerk response to the fact that a private company, which, yes, Pfizer absolutely is all up in that government money, folks. Like, there is the drug business is hugely dependent on taxpayer dollars. There is a prize here, basically, a sort of a kind of market making prize that is going to $2 billion that's going to go to Pfizer at the end of this. It is wrong to say that the government doesn't have any financial interest in drug development in the United States. On the other hand, These are private companies that have been working in an essentially private capacity, and they have worked at actual warp speed for developing these things. And his complaint doesn't have an alternative at all. It is a non-plan plan. It's just this plan is bad because it's got private companies.
Well, and you know, and more importantly, I think, is that the distribution of the vaccine is going to be done through private actors or whatever passes for private sector actors in the healthcare space. You know, Medicare and Medicaid are, you know, essentially, you know, distributed through private actors and things like that. There's nowhere in the country where you can reliably say we're just going to, you're going to go to the post office, you're going to go to the local K-12 school, which is probably going to be closed until 2025 anyway.
Now, Trump promised me that the generals were going to figure this out, right? It was going to be a military distribution program.
This is the inversion of Trump insisting that any kind of, transfer payment related to COVID has his name on the check. This is essentially Andrew Cuomo saying all of this should be done, you know, so that he and his, you know, ilk in state houses across the country get the credit for doing something that they didn't do.
Yeah, I really want to put a finer point on it. Like, please, God, let the private sector administer this. Oh, my God. The government has done a really bad job of handling coronavirus response, especially vis-a-vis, you know, the implementation of actual technical work. Oh, my God. Private sector only. Please, please, please.
All right. Let's turn to some other news that's happened since the last time we convened. With millions of votes still being counted, still lots of them, all of the major election projection vote tallying organizations out in the world agreed pretty much at the same time on Saturday morning Eastern time that Joe Biden. No, excuse me. Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., which suddenly is what the radio keeps telling me his name is.
Oh, my God.
Joseph Robinette Biden Jr.
That's President-elect Joseph
President-elect Joseph. Anyways, had secured enough electoral college votes to become the 46th president.
You know, shouldn't we get rid of the electoral college, Matt? That's all I was hearing. Why are we even talking about the Electoral College?
Joseph Robinette.
Joe Biden won through a racist, slavery-based institution? Come on.
Anyways, the number 45 president so far, and not very surprisingly, does not agree with the characterization of the various people who are calling this a done deal. He's launched a series of legal challenges to either reverse or to be seen as trying to reverse the recorded outcome in several of the states. He's also been speaking and tweeting about it, many of which speeches and tweets have been almost immediately yanked off the air by broadcast networks or suppressed by Twitter in the professed name of combating disinformation, which is kind of interesting. Meanwhile, other election news, Democrats unexpectedly, added some syllables there, lost seats in the House of Representatives, leading to an already spectacular round of infighting and circular firing squads, which is pretty enjoyable to watch from the outside. The control of the Senate currently stands at 48-48, as far as we know. Two of the 48 on the Democratic side are independents who caucus with the Democrats. There's two other outstanding races that will probably go Republican in Alaska and North Carolina, which would be 50-48. And then there are two outstanding runoff races in Georgia. I think they happen in January, the last of which certainly has the fingerprints of Libertarian Party spoiler in there because Georgia has, you have to get 50% plus one vote there. David Perdue is all sad at Libertarians. Speaking of Libertarians, Joe Jorgensen has about 1.17% of the vote, which is the second highest in the party's history. She defeated all other third party and independent candidates in all 50 states, plus the District of Columbia. Finally, drugs, including some fun ones, were legalized basically everywhere that they were on the ballot. And that is too much of a long summary, and sorry for it. Catherine, all elections are terrible and disappointing, as we know, even for non-participants. Maybe this one was kind of sort of better for libertarians than we expected.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have a feeling in my heart that I don't trust at all, which feels like okayness. If it's like, it's not even, I don't want to like describe it as like happiness, but it's like, okay, I'll take this. I think that the prospects for gridlock are pretty good in this current configuration. But I have long been a skeptic of the gridlock is the best case for libertarians thesis, partially because spending does still tend to grow under gridlock, sometimes more so. In this case, I have sort of two extra special qualms about gridlock. So I want to say, like, probably good news. This was probably in many ways the best case outcome, especially if it ends up with definitive GOP control of the Senate. At the same time, one, given the current climate, I think more gridlock may lead to more executive usurping of authority. That's already a dangerous trend that is in place. It's in place because even when there wasn't gridlock, Congress was having trouble getting its shiz together to actually do things. That will be quadruply true if the most likely electoral outcome does, in fact, manifest itself. I don't want Joe Biden to do more things via executive order, but far more important, I don't want presidents to have more power. And I think that that might be one place that this ends up. I don't love that. The other kind of qualm I have is that, you know, there is a shift in bipartisan consensus that debt and deficits don't matter. And while I do think that some Republicans are going to kind of swing back and, you know, scrape the mud off of the flag of fiscal discipline that they have trampled underfoot for so long and wave it with Welshian metaphorical fervor. But
folks, that is how you do a metaphor.
If you read the tea leaves, you can see that the foundations of our... No, I'll stop.
Are the tea leaves in the mud with the flag?
The tea leaves were in the mud with the flag.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that...
I just hope that flag was made in America, right?
That what I'm saying is that both parties are warmer toward debt and deficit. They are warmer toward larger government spending than they have been before. And that the extent to which the power of gridlock depends not only on generic partisan resentment and fighting, but also on someone somewhere thinking they can score political points by speaking up for fiscal discipline. Maybe that dynamic isn't going to work anymore. We'll see. But I have a little concern that the bipartisan agreement that A, Congress isn't really going to do anything. Maybe it should just be the president for everything. And B, maybe spending's not so bad, might make this gridlock less libertarian-y than past gridlocks, which were themselves still only libertarian in the limited sense.
Nick, we're not nearly at the end yet of this particular South Park episode, but preliminarily, have we learned any lessons today?
Well, to follow up on what Catherine is saying, you know, Joe Biden is already pouncing and he's talking, you know, he's got a phone, he's got a pen and a jitterbug phone, and he's going to start dialing up, you know, numbers. He has an ambitious list of executive actions.
Are you sure it's not a Motorola Razr?
He's going to be dialing those numbers from memory. He's old enough that he remembers phone numbers. So
yeah, he's the last landline in America. He's going to be calling from a payphone somewhere. But he, you know, he's going to come in. Most of the executive orders and actions that he's semi-announced, I mean, it sounds to me like a lot of them are trial balloons, actually, because we haven't seen definitive proof from him. Some of them are good, like restoring DACA to a semi-legal status or a more permanent semi-legal status, you know, and others, you know, are BS, like rejoining the Paris Accords. But he's also talked about reinstating all of the environmental regulations, that the Obama administration very cynically put into place towards the end of the Obama administration, and then Trump repealed before most of them were even in place. There's a lot of that kind of chatter. I think, what is good about this election, as Catherine was saying, is that it really revealed the lack of, even when you amp up voter participation to a rate that, you know, hasn't been seen in over 100 years, you get a dead heat because people don't like these parties. And these are we only have two words that we can use to express ourselves. And that does not cover where we are as a country. And I think it's good to see that, you know, Biden won, but barely. He ran well below what pollsters were saying. The House, the Democrats lost seats, you know, after picking up a bunch in 2018. They couldn't take the Senate. The Republicans are holding on, not because people love them, but because they're not the Democrats. You know, over 50% of voters who voted for Joe Biden, at least according to polls over the summer, said their main reason, or, you know, 56% of voters who were going for Biden said they were voting for him because he wasn't Trump. This is potentially a very good place for libertarians to be, because this, you know, it's clear nobody is satisfied with what's going on. And it's up to limited government libertarians to say, you know, to make the case that we need a government that does less and spends less, and does, you know, things that need to be done rather than every goddamn thing under the sun. I'm happy about this election, all things considered. I would have rather a Trump victory, to be quite honest, and divided government that way. But this is looking pretty good. And then when you throw in, just to blather on a little bit more, the seeming disaggregation of ethnic voting, racial and ethnic voting blocks, you can overstate this, but Trump picked up black support. He picked up Latino support, and people are now talking about Latinos as a diverse group of people rather than, you know, the equivalent of Europeans who all vote the same way or something, you know, in America. I think all of that is really good. And it's, in a way, it's a good development that Trump, the one demographic he lost support from, were white men. I mean, things are getting interesting, more weird, more personalized, and I think there's a lot to work with from a libertarian point of view.
That data that Nick is referencing is based on exit polls, which are pretty striking in the directions that he mentioned. The ghost of Stephanie Slade will tell us that those exit polls will be tweaked over time as we get more information. But preliminarily, it looks like that. And there are some counties, such as Starr County in Texas, most spectacularly, where which is heavily Latino, which had just a massive, massive flip, regardless of what exit polls say. But of the vote there in ways that are interesting. Suderman, big general takeaway from the election from your admittedly DC residing point of view.
You know how libertarians like to say it's a shame they can't both lose? I think this election outcome was about as close as you can get. I mean, obviously someone won, but Republicans lost the presidency. They lost Trump. They lost Trumpism in its purest form. Democrats, who were expecting to pick up seats in the House and to take control of the Senate, they won the presidency on an argument that was almost entirely about how the sitting president is bad, not how their candidate was good. And they didn't pick up, you know, they didn't pick up the House seats that they thought they were going to pick up. In fact, the reverse happened, and it looks likely that Republicans will maintain Senate control. This was a rebuke of both parties and their fringes. It was a repudiation of the worst ideas on both sides, socialism on the left, the kind of deranged, you know, mentally challenged populism of Trump on the right. And if you combine it with the other big result, which was just the sweeping rejection of the drug war, this was not a mandate for any sort of particular partisan vision of governance, of the future of the country. It was a mandate to leave us the hell alone, to fight amongst yourselves, and don't bother me. And I think that as far as election results go, that's about as good as you could reasonably expect. That's not to say that there are not going to be problems here, that there's not going to be a lot to complain about, a lot to criticize. But presuming Republicans do indeed hold the control of the Senate, this is about as good an election result as you could expect for libertarians.
Can I say, though, that libertarians in the major newspapers managed in absolutely classic libertarian style to disagree even about whether we are happy about this thing. So we had a very good piece by Liz Mayer, who is a libertarian-leaning Republican strategist in the New York Times, the headline of which is, "One group is unreservedly happy about the election results." And that group, of course, is libertarians. Meanwhile, in the Wall Street Journal, we have "Libertarians Spoil the Election" by Walter Block. And there
the
we are.
The head of Libertarians for Trump. Yeah.
The head of Libertarians. We are, libertarians are that joke about if you put two libertarians on a desert island, you immediately have three different libertarian parties. Like, it's wild, you guys. It's, they're both, they both make legitimate points, actually. And I'm glad that their opinions are being aired. But, oh my God, libertarians.
One small thing I wanted to say, since Nick brought up the shrinking of the racial gap in voting, which looks to be a real thing based on early exit polls that we shouldn't be completely relying on. But the evidence is mounting that there is at least some shrinking there. I think that is unreservedly a good thing. I totally agree with Nick, but we should note that it comes hand in hand with a widening of the education gap in terms of voting, and that is happening all over the Western world, not just in the United States, that as the racial gap is shrinking, it's becoming, you know, in the United States, college educated voters are just fleeing the Republican Party, and a world in which one party is sort of the party of the educated and the other party is the party of the less educated, I think is, there are some real tensions and problems and issues that arise from that kind of political divide.
That's also a rise in, that's reflected in rises of populism everywhere, right? Like, as soon as you get more populism of the left and of the right, and they usually happen at the same time, you get more city mouse versus country mouse. Nick, quick last word before I get to the mid-roll ad.
Yeah, the downside, as Catherine was pointing to, about 70% of federal spending is automatic, and it's increasing. So gridlock is not salvation. 20 years ago, people could plausibly say you would cock block half of the federal budget with gridlock, because only about 50% was mandatory. That's no longer the case, and that's a big problem. And I talked to Brian Riedel, a budget expert at the Manhattan Institute, and he said, you know, it's plausible that Republicans want $2 trillion in infrastructure, Democrats want $2 trillion in COVID recovery. They'll agree to spend $4 trillion. Rather than battle each other down to $1 trillion or something. It's not good, but it's a pause that refreshes slightly.
We are going to get to more libertarian schismatics and also Biden bullet points in a moment. But first, are you suffering from stress, anxiety, trouble sleeping, substance abuse, anger, bargaining, depression? Our friends at BetterHelp.com/roundtable to get your special 10% discount. Have a wondrous opportunity for professional, confidential help tailor-made to your specific needs and delivery systems. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, as in Miranda, gives you instant access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. Go to their website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe confidentially the problems you want to work on, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. Don't like that person, get a new one. Financial assistance also available. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, Catherine, you referenced the blame libertarians, happy libertarians. Let's talk about Libertarian Party. Exceeded the vote totals. I haven't rechecked the math this morning, but certainly so far in Georgia, likely in Pennsylvania, I don't think anymore in Nevada, maybe in Arizona, and then also the aforementioned role in Georgia Senate race. Spoiler, not spoiler. Should we be mad at Libertarian Party? Do they do great? Do they do bad? What's your take, non-voting small L Libertarian editor-in-chief?
I would kind of like to claim the best of both worlds here. First of all, I want to say that libertarians are not the spoilers in the sense that many Republicans especially think they are. And Matt, you of course are the expert on this, so I'm going to like libertarian stat-splain you a little here, I guess. I will do it anyway, which is to say, unlike when you say, well, was the Green Party candidate a spoiler? Was Ralph Nader a spoiler? All of Ralph Nader's votes were going to go to the Democratic Party, with the tiny exception of a couple people who had rounded the bend of the horseshoe. But with the Libertarian Party, that is far from clear. We have talked about that before on this podcast. Matt has written about this. Libertarians are often non-voters who are drawn out by the LP candidate, or sometimes they are Democrats. They are not all people who belonged to the Republican Party, and the GOP can get out of here with that. I hate it. It's very annoying. We don't belong to you. You told us this coalition was broken. You told us that libertarians were the cause of everyone's problems and that we were like making the teenage children twerk, and fine. Well, then we're gone. And you know what? That's on you. So I firstly want to say the idea that somehow
I think it was actually
everywhere,
the preteens.
The preteens are twerking. Sorry, that's our fault. To the extent that people want to say every single one of those LP votes should have been a Republican vote, and therefore those people are wrong. They're just like, they're like quantitatively wrong. At the same time, hey, look at this pool of voters. Look at the iceberg of voters floating above the water, and the many non-voters, I'm doing it, Matt, the many non-voters submerged below the water who share their sympathies and tendencies, who might perhaps be called out of their grumpy apathy if one of the major parties just gave like a smidge of an effort at incorporating some of their priorities and interests into their platforms. Just an idea for y'all to think about instead of just getting really, really mad the first like weekend of every November, once every 4 years. Like, why not try to appeal to those voters? So, not spoilers, could be winners for either of the major party should they give us the time of day. That's my iceberg.
Nick, I heard you sighing heavily. Was that about the state of your personal life, or did you have a comment germane to the Libertarian spoiler
election? I'm very upset about college football,
yeah,
Matt,
okay.
but also about the election. And I think the Libertarian Party, Matt, in a piece that you put up last week, you made the best case for, you know, Joe Jorgensen having the second best finish of a Libertarian candidate ever, even better than Gary Johnson in 2012 or Ed Clark in 1980, that's like a win. I think there's a really strong debate over whether or not the Libertarian Party should even bother anymore, or at least in its weird version where it's kind of an educational outreach program and it's kind of a serious party. I think that they would benefit from actually working through that problem and coming up with a strategy that they kind of polish and refine and go forward with, because this should have been a case like, you know, among other things, the Libertarian Party should have nominated Justin Amash. They should have done everything possible to have him come into this race. He is somebody who could have easily surpassed Johnson in terms of percentage. He would have been an actual difference maker, I think, in the election in a way that Jorgensen was not. And there's a fantastic video at Reason.com that people can go to that was put together by Zach Weismuller, where he talks with people who are on the side of saying, no, you know, the Libertarian Party has to become more hard, more like Ron Paul or more like Gary Johnson. And, that's an interesting debate for the party to have. But I think that, you know, we've reached the limit of this kind of halfway covenant between education and outreach and actual political action. And so I'm a little bit disappointed, actually, in the way this has played out.
Suderman, I don't want to hear you about this right now, because I want you instead to shift to the president-elect of the United States, the so-called president-elect of the United States, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. He's issued a series of bullet points and stuff about the executive orders that's going to make Catherine super happy on day one that he's going to sign. What, if anything, has jumped out at you about the content of any one of those particular orders?
I want to point out two things. The first is actually Biden's response to the announcement of the likelihood that Pfizer has a quite effective vaccine. And he put out a statement this morning, the key line, I think, for us, of which is, this is why the head of the CDC warned this fall that for the foreseeable future, a mask remains a more potent weapon against the virus than the vaccine. Now, that's true in many ways. The vaccine is not available to us, but he is going to push forward with a kind of mask politics that we have not seen from President Trump, and that is going to be a shift in the way the president talks about COVID and about prevention there. But the other thing that I want to point out is just the entirety of the speech that he gave on Saturday night. I don't know if you guys watched this. I didn't watch it in real time. I watched it the next morning. It's about 15 minutes long. It was it was the most generic victory speech imaginable. Just platitude piled upon platitude. I mean, about the only thing that was really notable about it at all and was that he called, for not treating your political enemies, your political opponents as enemies. And like, that's good. I think that's a good thing for someone to say, period, if you're president, but especially like in an environment like this. But what really struck me was this was a 15-minute major speech by the president-elect, and there was no news. No news whatsoever. It was entirely fine, not great, and completely avoidable. And his first big action as president-elect, you know what it was? It was to put together a task force. It was like, let's name some people to a commission.
The joy in your voice in the words task force was... Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
It's like he is going to have task forces on the value of commissions, which will be set up on a bipartisan basis to determine what the best task forces are. And it's just going to be that all the way down. It's going to be long, ignorable speeches that are perfectly fine and basically inoffensive. And like, he's not going to be on Twitter. I mean, he's not going to be doing stuff. And especially, you know, if Republicans hold control of the Senate. Again, I don't want to overstate this. Biden will absolutely use executive power to do a bunch of stuff that I will object to and that will be important and will matter to the economy and matter to people's lives. The president will not cease to be important in any way. But what Biden is previewing here is a break from the need or the feeling that you constantly need to be paying attention to the president because Lord knows what he's going to do at any given moment.
Catherine, what has jumped out at you so far about the list of executive orders or trial ballooned plans?
I remain focused on immigration in particular, and obviously I am happy to see some of the damage that Trump has done on administration on immigration being reversed in short order. I really, really do not like that this fully cements the idea that we have a brand new immigration policy every 4 years. When Biden reverses everything that Trump reversed from Obama, that's a trend of three, sort of. And I don't think that it's good for the country. I think it's terrible for people who are trying to do long-term planning on important questions like, should I emigrate? Should I uproot my life and try to make a new life for myself and my family in the United States? Well, depends on who's president is not an answer that I want people to think or have in their minds.
Catherine, do you think that there's a realistic possibility of legislative action? I mean, if you have Democrats controlling the House, if you have Democrats controlling the House, and if you have nearly half of the Senate with Democrats and a couple of pro-immigration Republicans, then that means that plausibly, at least, there are the votes to, say, legalize Dreamers through the legislative process rather than through the executive branch.
I hope I'm wrong, but I think there is a very clear track record of even in moments when it seemed reasonable to be optimistic in the way that you just described about bipartisan legislative immigration reform, that it keeps falling apart. And it falls apart because it's a winning issue for both parties to demagogue, not just Republicans, Democrats, too. And this is what I was sort of saying is that I think we are in the process of normalizing the idea that it is the president's prerogative who gets to cross our borders legally and who gets to stay here. And that ain't right. That is
Cemented by the Supreme Court in the variety of travel ban cases. They Correct. Did courts did trim the sails of the reach, thank you, of Trump's executive orders, but at the mm-hmm. end gave the presidency more latitude to make those calls than existed prior to those. Nick, you have mentioned previously the executive orders coming down the pike. What else jumps out at you about what's coming?
I think we've covered the executive orders somewhat. Two things to consider. One is that, you know, the Joe Biden we're seeing now is not the Joe Biden who's going to be inaugurated. There are two races in Georgia, the two Senate runoffs, which matter a lot. And already you see in Georgia somebody like Stacey Abrams, who, you know, still has not actually acknowledged that she lost a governor's race there a couple of years ago. Leading a charge, AOC saying, you know, we need to be more socialistic, we need to be more progressive and hard left. Biden is clearly, he's thinking about the strategy. How what does he do here as president-elect, and how does that affect the runoff in Georgia, where he might actually, you know, gain control, at least the slimmest of working majorities in the Senate or not. He is a candidate who ran, as the Washington Post said, his platform, his campaign platform was the most liberal ever by a Democratic candidate. He ran on $11 trillion in spending, and he ran on $3.6 trillion in tax hikes, again, which Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute calls the biggest tax increase since World War II. He ran an ideologically left, you know, far left campaign, which, because he wasn't as crazy as Bernie Sanders, you know, somehow he's a moderate.
Or even as his vice president.
Yeah. That this is not, you know, this is, I don't want to say it's a wolf in sheep's clothing, but it's like, let's see what he does once the dust has cleared on the election. And as Peter said, like, he didn't give a talk that was useful about anything. He's like, he's biding time right now.
He's and just biding.
We will
his
see
time.
Down yes. the road. Please, let's not do, go that way.
Oh, we're going to go that
but
way.
But we will see, I think, after the new year, exactly what his legislative and presidential priorities are. And they are not going to be conducive to libertarian sensibilities about limiting the size, scope, and spending of government. He's going to be doing everything he can.
The Georgia races are important because if Democrats win both of the runoffs in Georgia, they will have 50 seats in the Senate. And then that is effective control, since Kamala right. Harris will be the Senate tie-breaking vote.
And there you might see, because again, for all of the talk of Trump being, you know, the great colossus of norm-breaking and everything like that, it's, you know, the Democrats at every level were talking about playing footsie with breaking norms like getting rid of the legislative filibuster in the Senate. Who knows? Nancy Pelosi, who is like 800 years old, is also going to be have a real handful in the House, assuming she stays as Speaker. Because there is a wing of that party very far to the left that, you know, wants her gone because she's cock-blocked them like nobody's business. There are centrist Democrats who might be pushing back, and they would pull her in a different direction. There's a lot of drama to go in this, but I don't think we'll really see what it looks like until after the new
the
year.
The far left, center left civil war in the Democratic Party is going to be fascinating to watch. But I do think, you know, I have at least a little bit of hope is not the right word. Definitely not the right word. A small amount of tentative reassurance that even if Democrats, first of all, Democrats aren't likely to win both seats in Georgia. It's not impossible, but you shouldn't bet on them winning both seats. But even if they somehow or another manage to win both seats, have 50 seats in the Senate plus the majority with Harris, that means that every piece of legislation that they put through is either going to have to go through the most moderate Democrat in the Senate or get bipartisan support. And that is not going to that is going to produce a lot of legislation that all four of us strongly dislike and oppose. But it is going to moderate to some extent Democrats' legislative ambitions if you've got to either get, you know, Susan Collins or Joe Manchin to sign off on anything in order to get it through.
Catherine, let's switch to our end of podcast. What are you consuming?
Oh, I'm sorry, Matt. May I extend the discussion just slightly to ask people what is wrong with the Republican Party? You know, we've talked about, okay, how this affects the Democratic Party. But like the Republican Party sucks, and they lost an easy presidential election, actually, I think, because of the conduct of the president over the last 6 to 8 months. And what about, like, where are the Ted Cruz's and Marco Rubio and the Rand Pauls, the Tea Party darlings? Like, have they changed at all, or are they even more useless than they used to be?
I think that's a fascinating topic for next week's podcast, Nick. As it is okay. 2:50 for no, seriously, it is a fascinating topic.
Luckily, we do this every week,
and not just because I have a forthcoming piece on precisely that subject, which I hope to shape all of your opinions.
I love
decisively.
A cliffhanger.
Cliffhanger. Let's go to what we've been consuming besides newly legalized psilocybin drugs. Catherine, cultural consumption, go.
I am very, very late to this party, and we've already talked about it on the podcast, so I will keep it brief, but I finally started watching Upload, which is a Amazon Prime series. You know, was it me literally being like, can I leave this plane of existence and upload my brain to another one? How would that go, she wondered, at the end of a long and terrible election week. And the answer is like, possibly mixed results, I think, is the thesis of the show, as far as I can tell so far. But lots to like in there.
Have you finished the series?
No. I know perhaps everyone else on this podcast has. But so far, I will say just like lots to like in there for people who are A, looking for escapism, and B, who are interested in a sort of wry, realistic, I would say, like, Upload is to Black Mirror as Veep is to House of Cards. Everybody's just sort of silly and moderately incompetent. The dark, sinister evil doesn't manifest. It's just a goof.
Veep, it's Upload is for the post-human, like, future, what Veep is to the vice presidency.
Yeah.
Right? That. It's like...
Yeah. Basically, the idea that the future will be like silly and kind of muddle through and not be the dark, sinister world dystopian that we fear, but also not be a glorious, shining city on a hill.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
I watched What Killed Michael Brown, a documentary film by Eli Steele with his father, Shelby Steele, who wrote it and narrates it. And it is a look at the 2014 killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And it uses that as a launching pad to, you know, provide a very strongly felt critique of race relations in America by Shelby Steele, who has been in the public eye since the very early 90s when he wrote a book called The Content of Our Character. And it is a searing critique of what he considers an unholy alliance between white people who feel a lot of racial guilt and essentially kind of Black hustlers who are using race to exert a fair amount of power among elite Black circles without actually helping Black people at all. And it's a very good documentary. It is very polemical, and I don't agree with all of it. I've interviewed Shelby Steele, and well, you know, that'll be coming out on a podcast interview sometime soon. But it is a bracing movie to watch and an argument to consider at the end of, you know, months of unrest over police brutality and more, you know, in a larger sense, the position and the status of Blacks in America. So What Killed Michael Brown, it's streaming all over the place. It had originally been blocked a little bit on Amazon. They were not going to host it. They have since walked that back. But What Killed Michael Brown, a film by Eli Steele.
Suderman.
I have been playing the video game Wasteland 3 for the people who are concerned with the technical aspects here. It is an isometric, turn-based, squad-based role-playing game, sort of a cross between Diablo, Fallout, and Mass Effect. But what that really means is it's a top-down story and dialogue-heavy game with a lot of emphasis on choice and consequences, as well as tactical combat, and also a lot of really goofy dark political humor. So the game is set in a post-apocalyptic Colorado, where you're part of this sort of like roving private security squad known as the Rangers. You arrive and you end up having to work for and with the local like warlord leader, who is known as the Patriarch. And he has three children who have kind of gone wild and set up competing cult factions that are around, you know, around Colorado. And you've got to go and wrangle them for him while also maybe making decisions about whether you are going to support the Patriarch or not in his extremely brutal rule. But you get all sorts of just like goofy, bleak political humor, including like there's relatively early on you encounter a cult faction called the Gippers, who worship a Ronald Reagan AI that they have conscripted you into turning into a real person. And of course, there's choices about whether you're going to actually help them and do this or not, or whether you're going to fight them off, whether you're going to side with the warlord who has, you know, who is at war with his three children and that sort of thing. It's a well-made game, but it's also just like a fascinating and funny story, and an interesting example of the ways that games can tell stories and provide narratives and political commentary. The game, it's actually funny. The game opens with almost like a disclaimer that says this game is a work of fiction, ideas and dialogue. Stories we created early in the development process have in some cases been mirrored by our current reality. So that's what I've been playing while watching the election results unfold.
I watched a couple of weeks back a documentary that I enthusiastically recommend. It's a very small little thing, but very informative for lay people, enjoyers of the cinema. It's called Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound, a 2019 documentary directed by Midge Costin. Basically highlights the development from the beginning, but then sort of super charge through the the Raging Bulls period of the late 60s, early 70s, with George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Steven Spielberg, David Lynch, all these people, and specifically the great sound designers that emerged then: Walter Murch, obviously, Ben Burtt, Gary Rydstrom. And it's just a great little documentary, but it's the thing that's probably the best of it is that it actually explains in a very understandable way the construction of sound design in a movie, what all of these weird titles make and do, who does what, how you do it, and how this collaborates. It's super fascinating, educational. You will probably not, after having watched this, listened to a movie or experienced a movie in audio in quite the same way. Again, it made me want to go back to myself from 1987 or 1988. I forget. They had a rerun of theatrical run of Apocalypse Now back then. And I remember probably one of the last times I actually got super stoned was then. And I sat in the front row of the Arlington Theater of Santa Barbara, California, and just had my mind blown, particularly by the sound of that movie. And they do a great job in this documentary explaining what was so revolutionary about the creation of the sound for that insanely produced movie, Apocalypse Now. Anyways, making ways.
Were there a bunch of clips of John Travolta from Blowout?
Sadly, no.
Only movie about a sound design guy.
Sadly, no. You can find this movie, by the way, at makingwavesmovie.com, which links to all the various platforms that you can see it, etc. But pretty good. Check it out. Okay, next week we're going to talk about the future of the Republican Party. Or what the hell happened
Huzzah.
To it? Whatever.
Huzzah, Batwell.
It's going to be great. And I hope you all have a very nice week. Enjoy the Indian summer for those of you who are getting it. Is that racist? I'm not sure. Anyways, listen to all Reason podcasts over at reason.com/podcast, including the Wednesday interview with Nick Gillespie and the usually on Fridays Soho Forum with Gene Epstein and other luminaries. In fact, there's a relevant debates about the Libertarian Party in elections. There's a couple of them that I'll link to at the bottom of our link on this episode. Okay, goodbye. Thanks.